All right.
So our program was called Frontiers of Intense Labor Physics. And we gave the subtitle, What Happens When Intense Labor Light Interacts with Atoms, Molecules, Particles in the Vacuum, because I'm going to be talking about interaction with atoms, Andre interaction with molecules, and Kasia interacting with particles in the vacuum. And first of all, one should ask, why is this a frontier? And I would say a main goal of what I'm going to be talking about is the desire to image electronic motion on the natural timescale of such electronic motion. And just to give you an example, in the hydrogen atom, if you use the Bohr model for the ground state electron in hydrogen, you will find that the period of motion is about 152 attoseconds, which is, an attosecond is 10 to the minus 18 seconds. So if one is to take, to image electronic motion, one has to have tools, probes, that are of shorter duration than such motions. And attosecond physics was is focused on this, developing the probes that allow one to stop motion on such timescales. Now, we talk about intense, so let's talk about the intensity. When I first started going to meetings in the early 70s, most of the atomic physics meetings involved atomic collisions, and the laser people were in one room, maybe one session, talking to each other, because lasers were so weak that the only way that they could get data was to tune a resonance to two different energy levels in some atom, and they would look at resonant transitions. That changed through due to technological developments. I mean, at that time, lasers were of the order of 10 to the minus, 10 to the 10 watts per centimeter squared, just a factor of 10 to the 20 off. And they were very weak. By contrast, again, for an electron in the hydrogen atom, that is a proton and an electron, the electric field between these two is of order E squared over A zero, which is 3 times 10 to the 16 watts per centimeter squared. So if one is going to have pulses that, if you want to control electron motion, not just image it, but control, you're going to need intensities much, much higher. And technology came through. One first had Q switching, which allowed the energy in lasers to be incorporated in pulses. And so these pulses, because the energy was confined to a pulse rather than operating continuously, could increase in intensity. And then one had what's called mode locking that allowed these laser pulses to become very, very short. But the big advance that allowed intensities to get up to the vicinity of this area, like greater than 10 to the 14 watts per centimeter squared, was called chirped pulse amplification. Raising the intensity of lasers was stymied in the 1970s and 80s because once one reached a certain intensity, one destroyed the optics. And the optics are expensive, and so people didn't do that. But then chirp pulse amplification said, if you have one of these pulses of light, why not use a diffraction grating to spread out the pulses and then amplify each frequency separately, then recombine them. And this is what's called chirp pulse amplification. You take a pulse, analyze its frequency, amplify each frequency separately so that no one frequency's intensity is high enough to destroy the optics. And once this occurred, then one would have lasers of this intensity. And since I want to talk about attoseconds and measuring things on attosecond timescales, let's just focus on the process that has led to attoseconds, which is high harmonic generation. If you have a log of the yield as a harmonic number, yes.
We're talking about relative yield or potential, because if we're over zero.
This is you're right. This is the intensity that corresponds to this electric field. I'm sorry.
To potential is this A zero squared for electric field.
A zero squared
for electric field.
That's a potential.
Squared over A zero squared.
Yeah, this is the potential, which is the energy. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Right. That's the electric field that corresponds to this intensity.
Okay.
Sorry. So harmonic generation is this process. You have N times your laser photon, plus it interacts with some atom, and then it leaves the atom in its ground state and goes to a harmonic photon where the energy of the harmonic is N times H bar omega of the laser. So you have a driving laser field. You send in a laser field. Here's your atom. And you emit a harmonic that's a multiple of driving laser frequency. And of course, this starts because of electric dipole selection rules. You can only have with an atom odd harmonics. So you have 5, 7, and these are dropping logarithmically. And this is what you expect for a perturbative interaction between an atom and the light. But when one achieved intensities of this order and higher, one found that this leveled off and then started dropping again, and this was called a cutoff. And this excited people greatly because it means in this energy region, one has non-perturbative behavior. Perturbative would say every time you have a 1 over C interaction with the electromagnetic field, you should lose 2 orders of magnitude. But this is flat. And so people started fantasizing, what could I do with such a thing? If I can figure out how to extend this, I could get an X-ray laser. Most lasers today, the workhorse is Thai Sapphire, which has a photon frequency of 1.5 eV. 1.5 electron. Thai Sapphire. This is the workhorse. So immediately people started wondering, how do I understand this structure? Because only if you understand it can you hope to tweak things so that you could get coherent light at very high energies. And it turned out that Paul Corkum, who gave a talk here a few weeks ago, and Ken Schaefer and some others came up with what was called a three-step model that has allowed people to think of the physics in a way that allowed them to envisage new things they could do. And this three-step model, its main success was it predicted the cutoff energy for this so-called plateau. This is called the plateau. And plateaus are common elements of all intense laser atomic and molecular processes, not just for harmonic generation, but also other processes. This three-step model is essentially one-dimensional Newton's equation. So your mechanics undergraduates could predict the energy of this cutoff, and basically what it is that let's assume you have an electron bound in an atomic potential, and this is x. I'm looking at the, not in spherical coordinates, but just in Cartesian coordinates, and now you put on a laser field, xe, that's the energy. If you combine these two, you see that the combined potential looks like that colored line. And so this electron can now tunnel through. This is quantum tunneling. It can escape with zero velocity and end up free. So the first step in the three-step model is tunneling ionization. The second step is that once the electron is free, it's accelerated by the laser field. So maybe it's ionized here, and then it's accelerated, but then this electric field of the driving laser changes sign, so it's dragged back. And when it comes back, it can give up the energy that the driving laser field has given it, its kinetic energy, in terms of a burst of light. And this is an attosecond burst of light. The driving laser frequency is about 2.5 femtoseconds. So this is of attosecond duration, this burst of light. So this electron is dragged away after it tunnel ionizes. It's accelerated away and back. And when it gets in the vicinity of the atom, one of the things it could do is emit a harmonic photon and go back to its ground state. It could also ionize other electrons. It could also backscatter and be accelerated to higher energies. All of those processes have plateaus and cutoffs. But I'm just focusing now on the harmonic generation. So recollide and emit a burst or a pulse.
So
and
the emitted light goes in the opposite direction of the original laser pulse?
I don't know which direction it goes to. I mean, it's
or conserving momentum.
Yes, yes.
There is a nucleus there.
Yeah, I know.
And the momentum is.
No, I don't think people think about the
first approximation.
Because. So.
No. The laser is linearly polarized, so follows the polarization of the laser.
So if you look at this burst of light, which is on an attosecond time scale, because it's much, much smaller than the 2.5 femtosecond time scale of a Thai sapphire laser, this burst of light has a spectrum of harmonics that looks like this. And if, in the second step, you calculate the maximum kinetic energy so you use as your variable the time of ionization. It always starts out with zero velocity, and you figure out for one-dimensional motion in x that it goes out and then comes back, and you optimize the time of ionization so that it comes back with the maximum kinetic energy, you find that the cutoff energy is the binding potential of the atom, or the molecule, or whatever the target is, plus 3.17 UP, where this is the ponderable motive potential. UP is proportional to the intensity over the driving laser frequency squared, which is equal to the laser intensity times the laser wavelength squared. I mean, there are some factors in front here, but so you can see that if you, this is the binding energy, this is the intensity of the laser.
And in which units is it 17, because it's different dimension, right?
3.117 is dimensionless.
Right, but
UP has energy, and this is the binding energy.
Atomic units.
But it's, IL is not energy?
This is the intensity of the laser light.
Okay, sorry. That's what I asked.
Sorry to use I. So you can see that to increase the cutoff energy, you can increase your laser intensity. You could go to ions to get bigger binding energy, or you could increase the laser wavelength. Mm-hmm.
And this is a one-dimensional model. What happens in three-dimensional?
Experiment agrees with the predictions of this model.
But the radiation from the atom is, you have a beam coming in.
Yes.
And this radiation from the electron is isotropic?
No. No.
So what is angular distribution?
It's along the laser, the driving laser polarization. So I'm assuming that the driving laser is linearly polarized and the harmonics are emitted, which is one reason why the one-dimensional model works, because the electric field of the driving laser is along x, say. And then this electron is dragged away, comes back. Quantum mechanically, you have a wave packet which can spread. But the basic idea is conserved.
It's a connective effect, because there are many scatters.
Okay.
So it's forward scattering.
Which is
coherent.
Like when you start out with a narrow beam, you get a
narrow beam of harmonics.
Is the same word?
Yeah. What?
So anyway, I'm about nearly done. This is how one gets these bursts, these attosecond bursts that are of attosecond duration. If you analyze them, you can get coherent light. I guess the record now is the Gila group of Mario Murnane. They've done the Thai sapphire laser is 0.1 micrometers. Margaret Murnane is doing 4 micrometers and possibly up to 10. And the energies corresponding to these wavelengths for coherent light are in the KeV region. So for biologists, of course, harmonic generation could produce coherent light in the water window region between where water absorbs, between where water does not absorb and where carbon absorbs. In that water window region, one could take images of living matter, and having a coherent source that could do that would mean one could make holograms of living matter, possibly even while they live. So just to finish, once you have these bursts, suppose you have attosecond pulses, how do you get time information? And this is, again, very simple, attosecond streaking. That you send in an attopulse on a target, and you ionize, say, an electron. You initiate some process by ionizing an electron, and in the vicinity you have a laser field. And the reason why you can't do pump probe, you can't initiate a process with an attosecond pulse and then coherently, after some time delay, probe what you've started, because attosecond pulses are still too weak to do pump probe. So you have to find some other way to get timing information, and the way that's done is attosecond streaking. Because if you use an attosecond pulse to ionize at t equals t zero, then you're in the field of some infrared Thai sapphire laser field, and you use that electron will feel a force, again, Newton's equation, F equals ma, whereas here the force is minus the electric field of that IR laser, and this is dp dt. And the electric field of the laser is minus the time derivative of the laser's vector potential. And so now if you integrate both sides from t0 to infinity, you find that the laser at infinity minus, that this is the and since the field is off at your detector, the laser vector potential is zero at infinity, and so you have then that the momentum at t equals infinity, where your detector is equal to the momentum the electron is born with when it's ionized, plus the vector potential at that time of the ambient field. And so if you initiate a process with this, you can measure the time at which the electron appears in your detector by looking at the shifts from what you would expect the momentum to be if there were no field here. So by measuring the shift, you know when this appeared in this field. And so one success has been that in neon, which is 1s squared, 2s squared, 2p squared, plus an attosecond pulse, going to neon plus 2s minus 1, a hole in the 2s shell, or neon plus 2p minus 1, they have found that that this electron appears 20 attoseconds before this one. And so they have by this such a scheme, people are measuring the time of quantum transitions in matter that were not possible before. And they've also measured in tungsten crystals the time delay between ionizing a conduction electron or a tightly bound electron in a core. And they found 100 at a second difference.
Will the inner shells come out first?
In the tungsten crystal, the conduction band comes out 100 attoseconds before, which is obvious, intuitive. But this is not intuitive, but it may have to do with the angular structure of the orbit. So I'm done, and I'll turn this over to Andre Bendrog.
Okay, I'm a chemical physicist. I come from the active chemistry department, and on top of that, it's a French department. I'm from East Sherbrooke in Quebec. And I just found out from my wife that it's already snowing up there, so I'm happy to be here. All right. So I will limit myself, since my colleague has done a lot of the essential introductions to strong fields. I think what I will do is present you some of the results that were presented in this conference on the effect of very intense laser fields on molecules. And I will start with the simplest molecule, H2, just to remind you that a simple picture of H2 is a potential energy as a function of R under vibrational levels, 0, 1, 2. And the energy difference between this is H bar omega, and omega is 4,000 wave numbers. This corresponds to a vibrational period of 7.5 femtoseconds. Another case, this is H2, is the CH bond in all biological molecules. The vibrational period of this is about 10 femtoseconds. So clearly, to be able to observe motion of atoms inside molecules, and we like to control these singlet lasers, we need pulses that are shorter than, let's say, 10 femtoseconds, and attoseconds are therefore very useful for that. But one can also use very intense laser pulses to image molecules by doing something called Coulomb explosion. Just rip off all the electrons. Okay. And the simplest example that was published by Dürner in his red letter last year, again, for the H2 molecule, what you do, here's V equals 0. We know it's a Gaussian. V equals 1, we know it has a node. What you do is you rip off all the electrons, and you go into the continuum H plus plus H plus. And because the nuclear wave function has such a potential, is nearly localized, it's nearly a delta function at the different points. In fact, it's an area function for those of you who like mathematics. And so by just measuring the kinetic energy of the protons and the overlap between the vibrational wave functions, he was able to image vibrational wave functions. It's in Fizeroff letter. And so this is a simple example of intense laser fields to prove that vibrations exist, and one can actually measure vibrational wave functions in simple molecules. And recently, another talk that was given, a talk that was given here during the week, this is the acetylene molecule. The first ionic state. What happens is this proton starts moving. This is plus, and the question is, how does it do this? And one possibility is through a transition state. And what you do is you time delay with a very intense laser pulse the different paths that lead you to this thing. This is called vinylidene. You will all recognize the word vinyl, or used in materials. And what you do is you explode this completely, remove all the electrons. This explodes, and using techniques of nuclear physics, established a long time ago by Delbruck, I believe, from the kinetic energy of each one of these atoms, you can predict exactly, you can predict the shape of the intermediate state. So this system goes through here, and then through here. And by time delaying the Coulomb explosion, it's been established that it takes 20 femtoseconds for this thing to rearrange to that, and another 20 femtoseconds to go to the final product. So using very tense laser pulses on very short time scales, one can image the simple molecules.
Where's the other hydrogen?
You are right. It's either here or here, but it makes no difference, right? You're right. It breaks up into CH plus, plus CH plus, or CH plus, plus C plus, plus H plus. So all these things can be measured. The kinetic energy of all these particles can be measured. And from this, one can establish the intermediate structures on very short time scales. And to be able to do the Coulomb explosion, to rip off the electrons, we know, as Tony told us, you need very low frequency intense lasers. And my colleague, François Legarre, who's director of the Advanced Laser Light Source up in near Montreal, has been able to make very short intense pulses at 1.8 micron using something called, instead of time amplification, using a new technique called frequency amplification of laser pulses. If you go to lower, now this takes intensities of about 10 to the 15 watt per centimeter squared because you want to rip off all the electrons. It's called Coulomb explosion. And if I have time at the end, I will also show you Coulomb explosion of clusters, deuterium clusters, where you have 100 deuterium molecules. You come with a laser, you explode this. All the electrons fly off, the deuteriums fly off, collide to each other, and people have observed neutrons. You can actually induce nuclear reactions if you're not careful. Okay. Now, if you go to lower intensity, you can do something else. You can create new states called laser-induced bound states. And the simplest example, again, is H2+. What's nice about H2+, like a hydrogen atom, you can solve exactly the electronic states. The potentials are like this. This is the two hydrogen atoms, plus H plus. This is a binding state. This is anti-binding. But if you add photons to this at very high intensity, a useful picture is called a dress state picture. The initial state, the ground state, you add one photon to this, and then this state crosses it. Okay? After you have one photon absorbed, H bar omega. The transition moment between these two electronic states is very simple. It's R over 2. It was calculated in the 1940s by Mulliken, who got Nobel Prize for molecular orbital theory. And therefore, in the presence of electric field, there's a coupling between these two states, and you diagonalize this as a function of R, you get new potentials, laser-induced bound potentials. And of course, if you have a vibrational level, which was here, it will dissociate very quickly. But if you had a very high vibrational state, it can be trapped into these new laser-induced crossings. Now, this is done for the laser field parallel to the molecule as a function of angle between the internuclear distance and the electric field. You have cosine of sine of theta, and the theta of pi over 2, the coupling disappears. You have this. This is called a conical intersection. So this is a laser-induced conical intersection. It's just been identified by Phil Buxbaum at Stanford. And the importance of this is that in many biological systems, you have conical intersections. For instance, in your retina, this conical section prevents your eye from being fried. Because what happens is light goes up here, you create a vibrational wave function, and the conical intersection allows the thing to relax onto the ground state. If you didn't have conical intersection, we wouldn't be here. Point is that now with lasers, one can induce these conical intersections in simple molecules, and the question is, can this be done in very big molecules, where, for instance, conical intersections already exist, and can one modify them with lasers? I should point out that for the people in quantum field theory, this already at this level here, in 1941, a famous physicist called Stuckelberg, who invented the concept of positrons as being negative electrons going back in time, he did the following. He took this potential and he went in the complex plane, R plus I alpha. And he showed that these conical these avoided crossings become conical intersections, and one can do the dynamics of such systems using complex coordinates. Okay. So these are laser-induced bound states, LIBS. They exist only, of course, during the laser pulse. And I just want to differentiate this from other LIBS called laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy. It's used by the Mars rover. Very simple. He picks up rocks. A very intense laser vaporizes completely the rocks. And then there's a little spectrometer that analyzes everything that was in the rocks. So intense lasers are now even present on Mars. Okay, now one very important concept that has emanated from simple model of interaction of a laser pulse with electrons, and Tony showed us, is the recollision model. Okay, and the idea is, you have an atom, and due to a tunneling, the electron leaves with zero initial velocity. And let's say the electron leaves here, over here. Because the field is positive, the electron will go in this direction. And then it sees a negative field, it comes back. Okay, this is inherent in intense laser fields. And the recombination energy is the ionization potential plus 3.17 UP. And in fact, I always pretend it's pi. It's pi UP. Quantum mechanics doesn't like 3.17. And in fact, in 1987, François Brunel from NRC up in Ottawa did a simulation, assuming an electron leaves a surface, it comes back, it strikes the surface, and he found that the recollision is pi UP. So it's still up in the air, but nevertheless, it's very close to 3.17. Okay. Now, what happens when you have a solid? You ionize the electron, it comes back, or does it go to the other atom? And recent experiments by David Rice at Stanford show that even a solid surface can emit harmonics. And the maximum energy depends on the electric field, not the intensity. And you can get this from a very simple block model. Okay. And so the question is, does the electron travel within the solid, or does it go out and come back to give you this thing that was predicted by Brunel? Now, suppose you have a molecule which is dissociating. And you ionize the electron with a very short pulse, the electron leaves, it can recombine at critical distances, and one finds that the recombination energy is IP plus alpha UP, and alpha depends on internuclear distance, and it's greater than 3.17 UP. But these are very difficult experiments to do, of course, because you have initially a molecule, and you created a dissociated gas, and therefore phase matching can be a problem. Okay. Now, the reason I show this is because one can use these ionized electrons in a molecule to image the orbitals of the electron. And a recent development is called holography. Well, electron holography. PE holography. And the eta is very similar, except that now one has the following. Again, use this very simple model of atomic ionization. When I'm positive, I leave, if I leave here, then when the field changes sign, I recollide approximately near zero energy. That's where the maximum energy is. However, you'll notice that when the electron recollides, part of it could have also, because the field is negative here, another part of the electron wave function can start ionizing. And so there's actually interference between these two pathways. And recent experiments are being developed to do what is called holography. This is a very simple ionization. It can be the reference for which you can calculate the wave function, the energy. But this recollision, this orbit here, which takes two-thirds of a cycle. Again, this comes out of you can see it's about two-thirds cycle. So you can see the electron is leaving, but it interferes with its next ionization step. So this is a new phenomenon in high-intensity laser physics. And for molecules, it allows to image molecular orbitals. There's a theory that accompanies this, and there's recent work in Nature by people from NRC and others. So these are very interesting new developments. And one person that I can mention is André Staudte at the National Research Council in Ottawa, who's developing this more precisely for imaging molecular orbitals inside molecules. Okay. Let me finish with something which allow me to hook up with quantum field theory. It's a phenomenon that actually, I hope you won't mind my saying so, I predicted in 1995. It's called enhanced ionization. It turns out, if you take a diatomic molecule, the probability of ionization as a function of internuclear distance has peaks. And for most molecules, there's one peak at about 2 angstroms. And there's another peak at 8 atomic units, which is about 4 angstroms. And this peak is usually 3 photon resonances. This peak here is very intense. And this is the ionization probability, let's say if I take H2 molecule of the separated atoms. So there's a huge peak at this internuclear distance. And the reason I say this is when you take a cluster of D2 molecule, the distance between D2 molecules on the average is 4 angstroms. It's a snowball at very low temperatures. So you start ionizing this, you create ions very readily in a simple molecule, you create this. And so there's a very simple picture for this in terms of molecular orbitals. In a very intense field, as Tony showed, for an atom, you can reproduce, you can replace this by a stress potential. And for the case of a molecule, which is a double well, right, there's a time scale for tunneling, call it tau t. But when I come with a laser field, I'm doing this. This level is up here, this level, and then half a cycle later, I'm here. So the system is continuously going with these two. And if the tunneling rate is much slower than the laser frequencies, the electrons remain trapped up here and up here. And this electron here ionizes very, very readily. And this is the simple model we use to explain enhanced ionization at large distances, because it's only at large distances that the tunneling between the two atomic orbitals here is slow. So we had the idea then, what happens in the relativistic limit, where you have plus mc squared, minus mc squared, and if you take two uranium atoms, you blow up all the electrons. So you have two 1s orbits, atomic orbitals. The tunneling across these two is very slow. The total energy of this is getting close to mc squared. There's two levels, as I showed you. Okay, and when you increase the intensity, these things split, and one of these levels falls into the negative C. We've estimated that this can occur at 10 to the 24 watt per centimeter squared, as compared to Schwinger's 10 to the 28 watt per centimeter squared limit. So this is an example of where enhanced ionization should occur in the relativistic limit at super high intensities, but at intensities which should be reachable in a couple of years. Up in Canada, there's an advanced laser light source. They've already reached 10 to the 22 watt per centimeter squared with a 5 femtosecond laser, 800 nanometers. So these intensities are going this. And this allows me to introduce my next speaker, Kasia, who's an expert in quantum electrodynamics.
So I have just 10 minutes, I was told, so I cannot tell you too much about what I prepared, which is extreme laser light. So what I wanted to tell you about is about the limits for achieving very intense laser fields. And let me start with showing how the intensity of the lasers has developed over the years. And I want to point out where we are currently. So the first operation of the laser was in 1960, and as Tony said, the intensity of this laser was more or less 10 to the 10 watts per centimeter squared. Then through all the technological progress that Tony discussed, we actually achieved 10 to the 22nd volts per centimeter squared. This is the record intensity. It was achieved in 2008 in the group of Professor Gerald Murrow at the University of Michigan. And up to today, this is the valid record. So now you need to realize that once you go through different regimes with intensity, you make the matter interact differently with different intense laser fields. So basically, what Tony and Andrea, most of Andrea's talk, referred to was the intensities of, let's say, roughly 10 to the 16 watts per centimeter squared, where we deal with nonlinear optics regime. And this laser intensities produce the electric field. The electric field is more or less square root of the intensity. They produce the electric field such that the work performed by this field over the wavelength of the laser field is approximately is comparable to the Coulomb bounding energy. Okay, so here we deal with bound electrons and we ionize them. Now, if you increase the intensity to, let's say, 10 to the 18 volts per centimeter squared, what we are entering is the relativistic nonlinear optics regime. Because in this intense laser field, what we are able to do is the work performed by this intense laser field would be comparable to the rest mass energy of the electron. So in this intense field, the free electrons would start to move relativistically. Now, if we were able to increase the intensity even farther to, let's say, 10 to the 22nd, to 10 to the 24th, we would be able to make proton move relativistically. So in this regime, we would have more or less this condition satisfied, right? Where this is the rest mass of the proton. And then if we were able to boost the laser intensity even farther to, let's say, 10 to the 29 volts per centimeter squared, then we would reach the so-called Schwinger limit, in which we would be able, just by shooting such intense laser field onto the electromagnetic vacuum, we would be able to turn it apart and pull out the electron-positron pairs out of the vacuum. So as you can see, we are much lower than what is particularly necessary for the so-called Schwinger perproduction, which I just described, happen. So nevertheless, even though we don't have that intense laser fields, we are still able to use the laser fields that we have in the lab in a very interesting way. And I want to give two examples because I think that this is interesting from the point of view of the medical applications. So basically, I want to tell you a few words about how one can use the intense laser field to accelerate particles. So, how this can be done with the laser. So basically, you shoot the very intense laser field into a gas jet. So what it does, I mean, the peak intensity is, let's say, 10 to the 22nd volt per centimeter squared, but already at the foot of the laser pulse, we have the intensity which allows you to ionize the gas. So basically, you are ionizing the gas just on the foot of the laser field, and then what you do further is basically you have these electrons and the nuclei, and this strong field allows you to separate electrons from the nuclei, right? So here, somewhere behind the laser pulse, you have, you know, electrons and the nuclei, which are much heavier than the electrons, therefore they stay behind the electrons. And basically what you are producing in between these two macroscopic objects is the static, very strong electric field. And this region is moving in the wake of the laser pulse, okay? So with this very intense electrostatic field here, you are able to actually accelerate electrons, charged particles, to very high energies. And let me show you. I check out the numbers for electron acceleration. So using what is called laser wake field acceleration that I just described, technique, you can accelerate electrons to the energy of 1 GeV over the distance of 3.3 centimeter. Okay? Whereas the same you can achieve with conventional accelerators, so you can end up with that energetic electrons, but for this you will require 64 meters of accelerator to get the same result. So this is quite an advantage from the point of view how compact these laser-based accelerators can be. And of course, what I want to say, particularly for the superbugs participants in the audience, is that of course this technique can be used for proton acceleration, right? And then, as most of you probably know, proton can be used for cancer therapy. So actually, with the lasers, we can really do some interesting and very useful things like proton acceleration. But then, of course, once you have these very energetic particles, you can go even further and you can do the following experiment. So you have the laser beam, and then you split it up into two parts, right? With one beam, you basically are able to accelerate electrons to this GV energies, let's say. And then you collide these electrons with the second beam of your pulse, right? And once you do this, you can produce highly energetic, so you can produce highly energetic radiation, which would be in the regime of X-ray or even gamma ray radiation, right? And this is nothing else which already Compton was talking about, that in his work he so this process is called Compton scattering, right? But what Compton proposed is to use a weak light source, for which reason the electron was more or less absorbing just one photon, right? This is what we call today linear Compton scattering, whereas this process where with very intense laser field is what is called nonlinear Compton scattering, just because we are absorbing very many photons out of the laser pulse, and for this reason we are able to emit highly energetic radiation, right? And this radiation has very nice properties. It's nearly monoenergetic, so all the radiation coming out of our device would have nearly the same energy, and this of course would be also very useful for medical applications, such that if you would prepare the dose of X-ray radiation out of this device, then you would really have very little of unwanted radiation in your dose. So this, in my opinion, would allow you to more precise procedures to be carried out. Okay, so this is just to point out to you that powerful lasers have very powerful applications. Okay, so now, yeah, I wanted to talk more, but
we have a question period now, so maybe someone could set you up with a question. David?
Yeah, on the scale, where, when do you are able, when are you able to affect the motion of protons within the nucleus?
Protons within nucleus.
I can accelerate
protons with, let's say, 10 to the 24th volts per centimeter squared.
But you'd need also very short wavelengths, I suppose.
This is for optical lasers, so this is, let's say, for 800 nanometers, let's say.
Cosmos, I wonder that because this electron that it should be kind of backward reaction, that in this way would limit your laser intensity, because when you are producing them, I'm not sure whether it's relevant, but it's kind of natural to ask, right?
Yeah, I mean, okay, what you are talking about is just another topic that one can give a lecture on, because of course we know that there is something like radiation reaction force, and we had lectures during this program, and people are basically arguing how one can introduce it theoretically in a correct way. And one of our invited speakers, Dan Umstetter from the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, who is experimentalist, and he has a petawatt laser, said that there is so much chaos in the literature that he actually has to do the experiment to figure out things about radiation reaction force.
Other questions? Tony, do you have a question?
Yes.
Yeah.
What process in relativistic optics might make the biggest splash in the future.
What do you mean the biggest splash? What does it mean?
What would be the most interesting new physics that one could find with these kind of like measures?
Okay, in my opinion, of course, everybody would give you a different answer depending on what the person is working on, okay? So, in my opinion, per production, for instance. But I'm sure that, you know, everybody would just, you know. Yeah, per production with the laser field, there are, you know, different scenarios. One which was not really achieved in the experiment is when you collide nuclei with very intense laser field. This is what is called Bethe-Heitler process. If the laser field is very strong, it would be nonlinear Bethe-Heitler process. And you are depositing as much of the energy, right, that then the electron and positron pairs are produced. So this is something which I hope Don will also do some experiment on.
So you don't need 10 to the 29 watts position?
No, one doesn't have to have this high of the intensity because of the Lorentz boost. So you have, let's say, you can take 10 to the 22 watts per centimeter squared, 800 nanometer laser light, and you take very energetic electrons, right? Characterized by Lorentz factor gamma. And then actually what these electrons can see is the electric field of the laser pulse boosted by 2 gamma, let's say, which means intensity would be like a gamma squared. You know, this is in the rest frame of the electron. That's what the electron would see. So in this sense, the electron doesn't need to go to 10 to the 29 volts per centimeter squared. I mean, it can experience this, it experiences this strong field even for that intense laser field. It just has to be very relativistic electron, right?
Well, I think on that note, we can all dream about if we had a pocket-sized source of positrons, what we do with it, but let's thank our three speakers. Thank you.